A lot of logistics there. All right, let's begin. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher bachar banu mikol hamim V'na'atan lanu et torato Baruch atah Adonai Notein ha-Torah. Amen. And thank you for the water, whoever got it for me. Just an announcement about an event that's coming up. I'm going to be out of town for it. But at the Jewish Experience, there's this event that's called Rapunzel. This woman who comes to show how to wrap hair. If you're ever interested in wearing scarves, this is for women who have hair loss for whatever reason or cover for religious reasons, to learn how to beautifully arrange and tie scarves. So it's going to be at the Jewish Experience, and it's going to be this Sunday at 7 o'clock, and it's for women only. And so she goes around the country doing these like demonstrations. It's just fun sometimes to see, like, how did she do that? Especially if you ever travel in Israel and you see the women, the way they do it. It's so gorgeous and so intricate. And you're just sitting there staring at their heads like, how did you do that? It's at the Jewish Experience, which is at 399 South Monaco, which is at the corner of Monaco and Dakota. It's one block south. It's just like across the street and over. It's one block south of Alameda. So you're welcome to come. Yeah, should be really fun. I'm sorry I'm missing it. I'm going to Baltimore for a wedding. So. All right. This Shabbos is a special Shabbos. The Shabbos is Shabbat Para, which is, doesn't translate well. It sounds like the Chinese year of the cow. But that's basically what we're saying, is that this is the Shabbos of the cow, the Shabbos of the red heifer. And it is one of the special Shabboses that we have before Pesach. And it always comes before next week, which is another special Shabbos, which is Shabbat HaChodesh, which isn't Rosh Chodesh. It means the Shabbos of the month, meaning the month of Nisan, meaning the month when Pesach comes, the month that inaugurates the beginning of the Jewish people. So it goes Shabbat Para and then Shabbat HaChodesh. Shabbat Para is the Shabbos where we're going to have a special maftir, a special Torah reading, in addition to the double Torah portion that we're also going to read of Vayakhel and Pekudei. So it's going to be an extra long Torah reading, a double portion, plus then a second Torah when we'll read the section of the Para Aduma, the red heifer, which comes from the Parsha of Chukat, which is later in the book of Bamidbar. So if you want to actually turn instead to this week's Parsha, we're going to turn to page 839. So we read this then really twice a year. We read this within its regular Torah reading, so we'll be reading it again this summer, but then this section is going to be read this Shabbos. And it's the Parsha of the Para Aduma. Who knows or remembers what the Para Aduma, the red heifer, what that's all about? What is the red heifer thing that we're reading here? Yomi. It is very, thank you, Hazel. That sums up this class. We're going to learn something that's very complicated.
You have to burn the red heifer, and then the ashes are mixed with water to purify you from being next to a dead body.
Right.
But the person that burns it gets...
Right. The person who's pure, tahor, becomes tameh, ritually impure. And the person who's impure, who's tameh, becomes tahor, ritually pure. So yeah, it's the most mysterious of all of the rituals that we have. Diane, what were you going to ask or say?
Are you saying that this Shabbat there are three
parashas? Basically, we're not going to read the entire Parsha of Chukat. We're going to read the Parsha of Vayakhel and Pekudei. It's a double portion. And then there'll be a second Torah taken out, and they will roll it to this Parsha of Chukat. We will not read the entire Parsha of Chukat. We're only going to read the section about the red heifer, which is the beginning part of that Parsha. And it's interesting because the word Chukat, which is the name of that Parsha, really relates to the nature of the red heifer, which the Torah says, why don't we read it? And Diane, why don't you read that on page 839, verses 1 and 2.
Hashem spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, Hashem has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and they shall take to you a completely red cow, which is without blemish, and upon which a yoke has not come.
Okay, great. So when it says this is the decree of the Torah, that is the word zot chukat ha-Torah. That's where the parsha gets its name, is from chukat. This is a chok of the Torah, and a chok are the mitzvahs for which we do not have any explanation. And the chok of the red heifer is the one that is considered the deepest of all of them. The King Solomon himself, who was the wisest person, who was given and was privy to wisdom and understanding and insights into the deepest levels, could not understand this, even though he thought he would be able to. So this is something we do not understand and we cannot understand, and that we accept with faith, with trust, that this is a commandment of Hashem. We're told that the chukot, the chukim, that those are the ones that the goyim, the non-Jewish people, tease us about and say, like, what are you doing that for? That makes no sense. It's not logical. I would venture to say that, unfortunately, there are many Jews who would say the same thing. What are you doing that for? That doesn't make any sense. Could say that about a lot of the different mitzvot we have. At some level, all of the mitzvot are chukim. All of them, at some level, are not understandable. It's just as a side benefit, as a bonus, that God gives us some understanding of them so that we can relate to them more. But this one is held out as the one that is completely, we don't understand. So this chok about the red heifer, says the red heifer's waters, as Naomi said, is sprinkled on somebody who has come into contact with a corpse. And a dead body has the highest level of what's called tuma, of ritual impurity. Ritual impurity that something has is always equally commensurate with how much holiness it had. So because human life is the highest level of kedusha, of holiness, when the neshama leaves that body, the tuma that comes in is directly proportional to how much sanctity was there. That's why we have other levels of tuma also. So when a woman menstruates, she's also in a state of tuma, because when she loses the egg that did not become fertilized and did not become a child, that potential for life is called a whisper of death. It's just a touch of death, and so there's a level of tuma. Though we see normally in all of the other aspects of tuma that are related in the Torah, for whatever somebody has, the tuma can be taken care of, can be counter-affected by immersion in a mikvah. And the mikvah, the mayim chayim, the living waters of mikvah, restore someone to a place of tahara, of cleansing, of spiritual purification. However, in contact with a dead body requires something more than mikvah. It requires para aduma plus mikvah. Now the truth is that all of us are considered to be in a state of tumas mate, which means the state of tuma of having been in contact with a dead body. Because if you have ever been in the same room with a dead body, in the same building where there have been doors that were open, you were under the same roof, if you have been in a funeral parlor where there's a dead body, if you have been in a cemetery where there's a dead body. So we're all considered to have tumas mate. We all have that level of tuma. And it's for that reason that the Rambam, Maimonides, says, and his psak, his ruling on halacha, is that's the reason we do not go up to the Temple Mount. We don't not go up there because some people politically don't want us to be there. We don't go up there because we are in a state of tumas mate. We have that spiritual impurity from having been in contact with a dead body. And when Mashiach comes and we have the red heifer, we will all be sprinkled with that, and we will all be restored to a state of tahara, of ritual purity, and then we can go up to the Temple Mount. So that had to be taken care of. It was also what was necessary before someone ate the Korban Pesach. Before they ate the Passover offering, you had to be in a state of ritual purity, and you had to, if you had been in contact with a dead body, you had to go through the Parah Aduma first, and then you could partake of the Passover sacrifice. The Parah Aduma is the red heifer. So the Parah Aduma was burned, and then its ashes were mixed with water, and they were sprinkled on the person.
What happens to the people who wash the dead body?
So interesting, they also have tumas mate. Because they have that tuma, but there's nothing to be done. They don't. Interestingly, they don't have any more of it than you and I do.
So they don't have to do anything other than just go through the mikvah.
They don't even have to go to the mikvah.
Because
they
do. It is very high level.
It's very high level. But it's we're not saying, we don't believe, you know, that's the highest level mitzvah to do, is to prepare a dead body. That's the Chevra Kadisha, the holy friends who do that. And part of what they do is a tahara. It's interesting. Part of what they do is to wash the body before burial, which is part of the purification of the person who has passed away for them to then be buried. But being in contact with the dead body does render them tamei. And but because there's no red heifer, if we lived in a time when we had the red heifer, then they would go to the Beit HaMikdash, they would go to the temple, they would be sprinkled with that, then they would immerse in mikvah, and they would be good and restored to the natural place of tahara. So basically, it's a very strange, interesting thing. Marcia?
Were there some other things that maybe more superstitions that were around the red heifer?
Interestingly, no. So Judaism is not a superstitious religion. Now, there are superstitious people who happen to be Jewish, and there are European Christian superstitious things, but it was not superstitious at all. It was first of all, we know from the Torah, to bury a body, to come into contact with the dead body is a mitzvah.
Specifically the red heifer?
Red heifer, no. Yeah, no, it's not at all. What's interesting is they are breeding the red heifer now in Israel. Actually, it's not in Israel. It's somebody who has it, a non-Jewish rancher who has it. And it's like it's being protected, like I don't know, they got an insurance policy on it, because he's hoping it's considered a great merit to be the one that would produce the red heifer. So they want to have it ready in case Mashiach comes tomorrow before Shabbos. The red heifer will be ready, because we'll all want to go through the process so that we can have that level of tahara, to have that level of purity. So that comes in. So this year, this class comes from the beautiful teaching of Rabbi Moshe Wolfson. It's all based on Gemaras, the Talmud, lots of writings, etc. So we talk about why we have this now. So interestingly, we are usually in our holiday cycle, when we think about the darkest time of the year and the holiday that we have at the darkest time of the year, what holiday do we think of? Hanukkah in the winter, right, which overlaps, it's in December, you know, the Kislev, and it's at the end of the month. It's the only holiday that spans a Rosh Chodesh. We have 2 months, so we're like at the darkest time of the month. So there are different kinds of darkness. There's darkness when it's dark, and then there's darkness that comes from being deep and hidden. It says that this time of the year, when we're in the month of Adar, is considered the most hidden type of month, the hidden month of the year, and we just came off of Purim. So Shabbat Parah always comes after Purim. Purim is about, we read the Megillah, and God's hand was hidden in the Megillah. And we go from a place of hiding, a place of hiddenness, to further into the month of Adar, when we get to Shabbat Parah, which is always at the end of the month of Adar, to even a deeper hiding when we get to a mitzvah that is not just like, oh, we don't see God, it's like, we don't even get it. When you read the Megillah, there's nothing in there that's bizarre. It's just like interesting coincidence, but it's all normal. Parah Aduma goes to a place of, that's not normal. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We don't read the Megillah and say, oh, that makes no sense. It makes sense, we just don't see God's hand. But when it comes to Parah Aduma, we're going to a level that's even deeper. It's like, we do not get this at all. So even though we tend to think of the calendar as going like in a circle, which it does, in some level, it goes vertically as well. Nisan is the top, where there is the most light, and we're going to have revelation, we're going to have the Exodus, we're going to have everything where God's hand is completely revealed in the plagues, in the Exodus, in the splitting of the sea. All that is Nisan, and the month Nisan is related to the word Nes, which means miracle, open miracles. But the last month of the year, as we go through the year, we're going down, 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 and getting deeper and deeper until we don't see anything. And Parah Aduma is the lowest of the low, not in a negative way, but in the most hidden, deepest place. So we have the month of Adar is about hiddenness, Parah Aduma at the very, very depths. And that this is the place that we need to go through in order to come back, to spring back when we get to next week's special Shabbos of HaChodesh. On HaChodesh, from the word Chadash, we have a newness, the new month, the new calendar, the new year, everything begins, then we come back up to the top. We are kind of sprung there, by going through Parah Adumah. It says, this Shabbos, if you don't usually attend, this Shabbos is considered a very powerful Shabbos to be in the synagogue and to hear the reading of the Parah Adumah, because even though we don't have the Parah Adumah in the physical world anymore, we're told and taught that by hearing the Parah Adumah, that part read from the Torah, there is a level of spiritual cleansing, of restoration that happens to us in the inside level. That just like everything, like if you have a mitzvah, when we do a mitzvah, there's the action, the outside part of the mitzvah, and then there's also the internal part. There's the kavana, there's the intention, there's the intellectual part, there's the emotional part. Those are things you may not necessarily see in the external form. It says the same thing is true with the Parah Adumah. There's the external form of it, which is the burning of the heifer and the ashes and the sprinkling, but there's also the internal part, the internal transformation that also takes place. And that when we go and we listen to that reading of the Parah Adumah with intention and focus, that says we affect the internal change that is necessary, that restores ourselves internally to a state of tahara, of spiritual, and I'm going to say unblocking, because what tuma literally means is there's a blockage. There is something that is interfering with the connection to the life force with God. So we can see this, like with a person who has died, their neshama is no longer there. Now, yes, they are in God's hands and God's arms, etc., but their neshama is not there. That body cannot any longer connect with God because the neshama has been withdrawn. When we have had that, it was like, how do we get that reconnection? That's the state of tahara, is that reconnection. So the Parah Adumah, we have to wait for the actual red heifer. Reading and hearing the Parah Adumah in synagogue, read from, you know, the Torah, says that affects the internal part, even though we don't have the ability to do the external part. And that goes a long way, because that means that we will then be able to connect internally, says, to Torah, to all the spiritual light that's waiting to come to us from the month of Nisan. It is the way to restore our equilibrium as we've been through the dust of the year. And you know, just even, you know, when you just drive your car, it doesn't matter. Even if you're just driving, dust settles on your windshield. It doesn't matter if it was raining, it was snowing, it wasn't. Just going through time and space brings stuff on you and clouds our vision. So the same thing is true in the month of Adar. We need to be able to propel ourselves up to the month of Nisan, and we will do that through Shabbat Parah, through the reading of the Red Heifer, as we connect to the internal part of it. So what we want to understand too is, we said before, that Purim and the Parah Adumah are connected with each other. In fact, they share two letters, right? Pur, which is the root, because Purim is called Purim because of the word pur, is spelled Pei Vav Resh. Parah is spelled Pei Resh He. There's actually only a gematria difference of one between the two of them, because He is equal to 5 and Vav is equal to 6. So they add up, there's only a difference of one. So it says they are very closely connected, and it's not just their numbers, they're actual letters. Pei Resh, and then it's Vav and Hey are the only things that are different about those two words. So it says, again, it's hinting to this idea that the Parah has this depth and this hiddenness attached to it. Okay. We also understand that Purim, which was the saving of the Jewish people through God's hidden hand, was a level of rescue, was a level of redemption for us, a level of restoration, and that the Parah Adumah comes to complete the job that Purim started. Okay, so Purim was part of a salvation. You could say that Purim, that the Jewish people were still in Shushan. They were saved, but they were still outside the Holy Land. When somebody comes into contact with the dead body and they are in that state, they have to leave the camp. Just like somebody who has Sara'at, a person who has Sara'at because they've sinned and spoken Lashon Hara, that, remember Miriam who had to leave the camp. If you're in a state of Tuma, you have to leave the camp. When we talked about the Amalekites attacking the Jewish people, and how we had always understood that they attacked the elderly, the sick, and the weak, we understood that that wasn't exactly what it meant. It meant it attacked the people who were kind of outside of the camp and not under the clouds of glory. They were outside of God's protection, and so they were vulnerable. So you're saved from Amalek, but you're still outside of the camp. So you want to come back inside the camp. The only way to come back inside the camp is through the Para Aduma. So it says the Para brings us back inside the camp because the camp was a place of holiness. And that's where we want to be. That's the place where we can experience the most profound connection. Okay. All right. This is like so, this was just so interesting and new to me. When we come to Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which will be after next week, it says Rosh Chodesh Nisan is a Rosh Hashanah for something. It says Rosh Hashanah for kings. It says it's when new kings were appointed, when it was decided in the heavenly courts who was going to be king, not just the king of the Jewish people, the kings of all the different nations. It was decided the kings are about, when you have the Rosh Hashanah for kings, is on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. But there's another king whose kingship is determined on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, whether there will be a king. And that's God, is the King of Kings, that there is a tribunal. It's like, should this be the year that God becomes the king of all of the world? Like we say at the end of Aleinu, we say, what do we say? V'haya Hashem HaMelech al kol ha'aretz. And it will be that God will be the king over the whole world. Everyone will recognize God. God's kingship will be established. Right now we say, right now it's only our king. Not that we're hoarding him. It's just like, can only be the king of those who recognize God's kingship. But in the future, that there will be, when Mashiach comes, it will be determined whether God will be king. So this is going to happen on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It's going to be determined, is this the year when Mashiach comes and God becomes king of the whole world? So how do you think that goes in that tribunal? How do you think that decision is made? I'm sorry?
How we're doing.
It's like, are they worthy of having God king? Have they measured up? Is there enough reason? Do they have the merit? Have they fulfilled the mitzvahs? How are they acting? Do they deserve? Do they seem like they even want it? So it's going to be determined, like, are we ready for it? And so there's going to be, just like in any good court, there's going to be the prosecutor, who we call Satan, is going to get up and say, look at them. They're not worth it. They're not ready. And God lets the heavenly tribunal decide. However, God could decide to make the decision just say, you know what, I don't care what you say, I am the King of Kings after all, I can veto your decision, and I can decide this is going to be the year Mashiach's going to come, and I'll be king over there. I'm just going to do it, even though they're not ready, I'm going to just force the hand and just do it. Susan. Heavenly tribunal, so it says that there are malachim, that there are angels, and there's like a court. And there's a court, and there's a prosecutor and a defender, and Satan is the prosecutor.
But it's not people.
No, it's heavenly agents. But everything we do creates evidence that is brought to the trial. It's like, well, exhibit A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. So there's going to be like a hearing. Is this going to be the year? And so the Satan gets up to say, I think we never, you know, wait till next year. They're not ready. So the question is, how do we show that we're ready? And what would make God want to make us ready even if we're not ready? Like for no reason. It's like, I'm God, I'm just going to do it. It says, well, if God's going to do something without explanation, what's the countervailing thing that we could do that says without explanation to show that we're ready? It says, Para Aduma. It says, we're going to do a mitzvah and we're going to read the Para Aduma from the Torah and we're going to accept it internally and say, we may not be able to do it yet, but we're ready. We accept this for no other reason other than you commanded it, God. We don't need to understand it. And God is like, ah, so if you do it without understanding and for, quote, no reason, then I, midah keneged midah, measure for measure, I can also do for no reason, and I will bring it. But if we're going to say, oh, I have to have reasons, then God's going to say, then I have to have reasons. So it is a measure for measure response of the way that works. So the Para Aduma, when we do that, it's like, okay, this is why we're doing this before Rosh Chodesh Nisan. We're getting ready for this because we're going to counteract and we're going to shut Satan up. Okay? They're going to shut the prosecutor up and say, we're doing what we can do, and this is a total expression of emunah. That is acts to neutralize the accuser's accusations against us. Okay. To understand this a little bit more, we have to understand how, what the challenge is. It's like, human beings, what makes us so special is our intellect. Our intellect, in fact, is tied to our neshama. Okay, our neshamas and our intellect are deeply tied together. Judaism is a religion that requires the supreme use and mastery of the intellect. Look at it. You go to a yeshiva. I remember when I first started learning with Rabbi Tversky, I walked into TRI. I looked at all the shelves. I couldn't even read the titles of what was on there. I'm like, what is all of this? I grew up a chumash, a siddur, and a machzor for the holidays, and a little booklet with the Megillah. I thought that was kind of it. You know, what else is there? But there is so much more, and it requires tremendous intellectual application, and which is why this is an adult religion. This is not whatever we just learned and got through, and then we left after our bar bat mitzvah. Like, whoa, you weren't even started yet. You didn't even get in the front door yet. This requires tremendous intellect. Being a person, we pride ourselves on our intellect, and we pride ourselves on our ability to reason, rationalize, be logical, to evaluate, and to understand. So when something is told to us that it is outside our ability to understand, it gets our dander up. It's like, we just have a really hard time. There's a Yetzer Hara that's like, I can't accept that. Either I'm going to break my head trying to understand it, or I'll say it doesn't exist because anything that exists should be understandable to me. And so there's a real challenge there.
There are many things that we don't understand.
Yes, indeed there are. And some of them is just a matter of time, like we will understand it. And there's some things that are beyond our understanding. There's a lot of things. The Para Aduma comes to encapsulate the thing where we're commanded to. There's many things that we don't understand, but we're not asked to do it, to do something with it, the way we are with the Para Aduma. Because you're acting, you feel like you have, people have a big thing. It's like, you have to leave your intellect behind. It's like, at some point, yes, you do. At some point, you have to step. And it's not a leap of faith. It's a leap of saying, there's a limit to human intelligence, and I just met it. But you're right. There are many things. We should really understand that quite well, but it brings out our defense. It brings out the Yetzer Hara in us of not being able to understand. The other thing that is human nature is we don't like to wait. We do not like to wait for anything. We want it now. And in fact, you know, our society, our economy, the whole civilization has been, if you look at what has been the underlying theme that has moved civilization along and has moved progress along, it is, how can we do it faster? How can we do it faster? I want it now. In the microwave now is slow, you know, compared to, you know, before I had a flip phone, now I have a smartphone, and I want to see, you know, when I go on to my whatever, I want to see it like that. That message, that text message should be sent like that. If I'm just watching the bar until it's sent, it's like, oh, come on, come on, come on already. Okay, so waiting and not understanding can make us crazy. Okay, so that is the essence of human being in the place of the intellect. So we have to understand, how did the Yetzer Hara, how did Satan, when we say Satan and the Yetzer Hara, and we also talk about the Malach HaMavet, the angel of death, we said these are all the same concept. It takes different forms. And it takes a fourth form, which is called the Nachash. The Nachash, which was the snake, the serpent, in the Garden of Eden. So the Yetzer Hara becomes embodied, or the Satan becomes embodied in the Nachash, in the serpent, in the Garden of Eden. It tempts, and then it turns into the Satan and goes to the heaven and says, look what he did. So it becomes the tempter and the accuser and the prosecutor at the same time. And then after a judgment is made, it becomes the one who carries out the punishment. So this is like one big job. This is like way too much for one angel, but it's like all one job for one being. But how did that even come into the world to begin with? And for that, we really need to go back to Bereshit. We need to turn back, go all the way back to Genesis on page 15. And we want to understand what happened from a different perspective. And it's so interesting. It's not like there are tons and tons of words here, but when you see them through a different light, we can understand this. We're going to look at the serpent's enticement, the Nachash's enticement of Adam and Chava specifically. And we understand what was the nature of the enticement, so that's what we want to listen for. What was it that enticed Chava? What is it that she fell for that the Nachash told her? So let's start with verse 1 here. Okay, Janice, would you like to read for us?
Sure. Now the serpent was cunning beyond any beast of the field that Hashem God had made. He said to the woman, "Did perhaps God say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" The woman said to the serpent, "Of the fruit of any tree of the garden we may eat. Of the fruit of the tree which is in the center of the garden, God has said, 'You shall neither eat of it nor touch it, lest you die.'"
Okay, just as an aside, God told Adam not to eat it. He did not tell Adam not to touch it. Adam told Chava not to touch it, thinking, like, if something's so dangerous, you shouldn't even touch it. So he added on to that, which was an error, actually, on his part. And now the serpent is going to come in. And Hazel, why don't you continue verse 4?
The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. For God knows that on the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and bad."
Okay. What is the key thing that the serpent tells Chava? What is she going to be able to do? She's going to be like God in what way?
In
the wisdom, in knowing. Okay? In knowing the difference, in knowing good and bad. It says, that is the supreme intellect, is to know the difference between one thing and another. If you look at Talmudic halacha, being able to tell, is it this or is it this? Is it permitted or is it forbidden? Is it right or is it wrong? There's things you can say, oh, I can tell that. It's like, oh, no, you really can't. You can tell, like, maybe at the general level, but you start getting into the depths of something, it's not so easy to tell. Being able to tell what things really, really are, the difference between one thing and another, it says that is what we pride ourselves on, intellect. I still remember when we took our daughter to the zoo the first time, that she was able, or not the first time, but one of the first times when she was talking and identifying. She categorized things, they were either dogs or ducks. Okay? So you know that categorization, right? If it had four legs, it was a dog. And if it was a bird type thing, it was a duck. And then the next time we went, it got more refined to, you know, I don't know, horse, dog. I know you could watch the power of the intellect until you have kids now who, like, watch these really amazing shows and learn all these things. Oh, that's a such and such lizard. I'm like, that's a dromedary instead of a camel. It's like, what? I didn't even notice that. You know, like, what? Oh, one hump, two humps, whatever. Okay, so the ability to develop expertise in anything is being able to zero in on these minute differences between one thing and another. In music, in art, in medicine, all these things are about being able to tell the difference between one thing and another. So the appeal to Chava was, your intellect is going to be opened up to a brand new level. Whole level, you're going to be able to tell the difference. It says, Adam and Chava did not have an internal Yetzer Hara for physical pleasure. It wasn't like, this is going to be the best fruit of your life. The taste of it is just going to send you over the moon. It wasn't going to be even how it smells. It's not going to be how the aesthetic aspect of it. It wasn't any of that. It was an intellectual test. It was an intellectual test. And what happens to it? And the woman perceived that the tree was good for eating, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable as a means to wisdom. Lehaskil, right, that she was going to have seichel, okay, that she was going to give her wisdom. That was the temptation. And so then she takes of the fruit and she eats of that. You could say, that's a good thing. Like, why? What was wrong with that? So the answer to this is very interesting. It says, this tree of knowledge of good and evil was not supposed to be denied to Adam and Chava forever. It was only that it was not time yet. So this goes along the idea that that tree was in fact a grapevine, and that they were to have taken the grapes later in that day, because remember, they were created on the sixth day, they were created on Friday. They were to have taken those grapes from that grapevine, squeezed them, made grape juice, or whatever, maybe they get some level of wine out of it, to make kiddush for Friday night. Because that was going to be the first Shabbos in Gan Eden, and that would have been human perfection. It was only a matter of waiting. It wasn't a matter of not having at all, but they blew it. And by not having the patience to wait for it and wanting more than they were supposed to have until the time they were supposed to have it, it says that introduced and brought, it says it was as the Nachash, it says we have the idea, it's like how a snake or a serpent can kill in different ways. It can strangle you, but more importantly, the quicker form of death is venom. Okay, it says it injected its venom into humanity, and that venom is called the Yetzer Hara. So the serpent went from an external intellectual tempter inside and became the Yetzer Hara. It became incorporated inside of them. What's really interesting is we make a very big deal about having the ability to distinguish and to differentiate. In fact, we celebrate that at a very important time of the week. When do we celebrate the ability? Havdalah. When we say Hamavdil Bein Kodesh L'chol Bein Or L'choshech Bein Yisrael Amin Bein Yom HaShvi'i L'Sheshet Yomei HaMaaseh, all of the differences, the Jewish people, non-Jewish people, holy, ordinary, all of those things are the differences. And in fact, if you are in synagogue on Saturday evening before Havdalah is made, there's actually a part of the davening that is that you are actually making Havdalah, in fact. And that Havdalah, let me just see, hold on one second, let me get to it, is, it's in the Mariv, in the evening service, and it is, oh wait, that's not right. What? Sorry, that's not correct. Let me just get to it. Here it is, I have a bookmark. During the Mariv service, the evening service, in the Shmona Esrei, which are the 19 benedictions, we have one that says, insight. You graciously endow man with wisdom and teach insight to a frail mortal. We thank God for that. And then we say, endow us graciously from yourself with wisdom, insight, and discernment. If it is a Saturday night, you put in basically a Havdalah blessing that says you have graced us with intelligence to study your Torah, and you have taught us to perform the decrees you have willed, Hashem our God. You have distinguished between the sacred and the secular, between light and darkness, between Israel and the peoples, between the seventh day and the 6 days of labor. Our Father, our King, begin for us the days approaching us for peace, free from all sin, cleansed from all iniquity, and attached to fear of you, and endow us graciously from yourself with wisdom, insight, and discernment. Blessed are you, Hashem, gracious giver of wisdom. We're very big into wisdom. We're very big in the ability to make this differentiation, Hamavdil Bein Kodesh L'chol, between good and bad. That's what we are based on. But Adam and Chava wanted to know more than they were supposed to know at that time. They didn't wait, and it says, and that Yetzer Hara entered into them to be an ongoing challenge to humanity. And in fact, it comes again. So it says, this is called death, because where the Yetzer Hara goes in, God's presence goes out. Okay, the Yetzer Hara, the part the Yetzer Hara is in, is to the extent to which God's presence is out. So it's called as if death entered the world, because death is the part of the Yetzer Hara, the snake. Bless you. It doesn't mean that they died right then. You notice Adam and Chava did not die right then. But death became part of the world. We had a second opportunity to return to the Garden of Eden, our Garden of Eden state, where there would not be death anymore. And when was that time? Bless you. When was the time when we had a second opportunity to defeat death and to go back to the time of the Garden of Eden? It was at the giving of Torah. At Mount Sinai, it says the Jewish people, it said, were restored. It said all their illnesses were healed. It's like, we're getting ready. This is going to be the final thing. This is like going back to the Garden of Eden. We're going to restore the Jewish people and all of humanity to its rightful place, and there would have been immortality. So we know what happened. We heard the Ten Commandments, and then Moshe went to the top of Mount Sinai for how long?
40 days.
And what happened right at the end, before he came down? We built the golden calf. The men built the golden calf. Why did they build the golden calf? They miscalculated, and they couldn't wait. So you can miscalculate and wait, or you can miscalculate and build a golden calf. It says, in that moment of building the golden calf, it says, they lost it again for all of humanity. And death came back to them. It says they lost their crowns. They were given two crowns when they said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do it and we will listen. And the implied assumption is, and we will wait, and we will wait. It says, the women waited. So I was thinking about that. This is not from Rabbi Wolfson. I was thinking, women are designed to wait. If you think about it, just in pregnancy, you have to wait. I don't care how much of a hurry you're in. Okay, so you can schedule your C-section, but there's a limit. Okay, and it's just like, you have just like a limited time. And even to want to get pregnant, a man can impregnate, can release sperm whenever he wants to. A woman is only able to conceive a very narrow window. It's like, you need to wait. You need to wait. And when a woman is counting the days from the time of her menstrual cycle to immersion in mikvah, she counts days. You have to wait. It says a woman was designed to be able to wait. A man, not so much. Okay, a man, not so much. So the women didn't fall for that. They did not fall, and they didn't fall for it in Egypt, waiting for redemption when things were hard. They did not give up hope, and they waited. But they didn't wait just like, okay, I guess we're waiting. They waited expectantly, literally expecting. We're waiting, and when the time is right, we're ready to celebrate. We know Miriam and the women had tambourines. They were ready to celebrate. We're ready. We're not going to jump the gun, and we're not giving up. So that's what's hard about waiting, is because waiting can make you lethargic. It's difficult to wait and be enthusiastic at the same time, because it's hard to do that. The women at Mount Sinai waited. Either Moshe's coming back or God has another plan. But we're waiting. We do not need to jump the gun and to do anything that would go against what God says. So they didn't wait. Valerie. I'm sorry? Eve did not wait, so we'd have the tikkun, but maybe because she hadn't been pregnant yet.
In light of that, if Adam told Hava to not eat pork, touch it, why did she give it to him and he ate with her?
Because
why didn't he say no?
Because he listened to her voice. Women are designed to have a powerful influence over their husbands. That's why we were held more responsible, is because it was malfeasance. So when your advisor tells you to do something that is wrong and you do it, the person who has the higher level authority, your lawyer, your accountant, your doctor, they're more responsible. You are also responsible, but they're more responsible. He listened to her. He listened, and then he blamed, and then afterwards he blamed God for giving him his... Well, that woman you gave me, she told me to do it. Okay. It's being an ingrate. He was an ingrate. That's actually what got them kicked out of Eden, by the way, is he was an ingrate for her. Okay, so going back, so this idea about what happened is, in the Garden of Eden, then we had our second opportunity, which was going to be then at Mount Sinai with Moshe and the waiting. And it was just a miscalculation by hours. You know, it's very hard. I have that difficulty, just like miscalculating. When you look at an airplane ticket, at a flight schedule, and your flight leaves like at 1 a.m., but you know you like have to be at the airport like the day before. I mean, we've had relatives like being at the airport the wrong day, because they just like miscalculate like what was the day and all this. Anyway, Moshe told them 40, he meant complete days. They started counting the day he left. That's so they were off like by a half a day. If they just would have waited, we're just talking about hours. But when is it the hardest to wait? At the end. The same thing was true on Friday with Adam and Chava. How long was it until Shabbos?
Nothing.
Just a few hours. And how long was it before Moshe came? Just a few hours. It's like it's hardest to wait at the end. Same thing with delivery. What's the hardest part of the pregnancy and delivery? the end, okay? It's like you go the whole 9 months or whatever. It's the transition time at the end, like when you're just about to deliver, that you're ready to walk away and say, okay, I'm not doing this, I'm going home. It's like, oh, no, you're not, because it's actually just wait, and then it'll be done. So it's the hardest at the end. So it says this is our goal, and we make a tikkun. We do a repair for this, for being able to wait and to be able to counteract the impact of what brought death into the world by being able to wait. If you look, I'm sorry, we counteract this decree by being able to wait. So we are waiting for Mashiach. Interestingly, the gematria of Nachash, which means serpent, is exactly the same as Mashiach.
Ouch.
Okay, so it's like Mashiach comes to overturn the Nachash, but we have to wait. So even though in the Talmud it says that there will be 6,000 years of the way the world is now, and in the seventh millennium, then it will be Shabbos, and Mashiach will come. Even though it says that, we are not supposed to calculate. Even though we do, it's like, okay, 5775 minus 6,000, okay, 200, okay, we're calculating. We're not supposed to calculate, because it has been calculated before, and times it was wrong, and people get discouraged. And when people get discouraged when something has been calculated, then they do the wrong thing. So this was also miscalculated during the time before, when we had the opening of the Megillah. Ahasuerus, who made a feast, why did he make his party? The Jews attended the party. It was to celebrate that the 70 years had passed and the prophecy from the prophet Daniel was wrong, and the Jewish people did not return to the land of Israel, and they did not rebuild the temple. And the Jewish people were like, Daniel. He was a prophet. He had Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. And if you read the book of Daniel, I didn't go to look at it, all the details, he gives the timing of what the timing is going to be. And then it didn't happen, and the Jews just like became spiritually depressed. It's like, I guess it's not happening. We were wrong. I guess we're a Jewish. I might as well go to Ahasuerus' feast. So whenever we get discouraged with the waiting game, we do something wrong that triggers a big problem. So Adam and Chava did it wrong, brought mortality into the world. The Jewish people did it at Mount Sinai, brought the golden calf. That was wrong. And then later, Daniel gives the prophecy for the Jewish people returning to the land of Israel and rebuilding the second temple. He was miscalculated also. It was wrong. It was hidden from him, the true answer. So what do people love to do? Whenever I give classes, people are like, okay, when is redemption coming? Like, if you could just give me the date, like, then I can do it. It's like, we don't get to do that. So it says, just like we don't get to know when Mashiach is really coming, we don't get to know and understand Parah Aduma. So that when we go to Shul on Shabbat Parah, and we hear that section being read, it is an opportunity for us to say, it's okay, God, I don't understand this, and I can wait. I can wait. I'll wait. I'm waiting. And we can say, I'm waiting. And we're supposed to wait. And we have that, in fact, in our davening, too. And every morning, some people say this. It's not obligated, but some people say it. And if you feel like you need to say it because it would help you when you're feeling frustrated and like, when is this story going to reach its conclusion? Bless you. We have the Rambams. We have Maimonides, the 13 principles. And the 13 principles upon which the song of Yigdal is also written. We sing those principles, so if you just want to sing that song, that's fine too. But amongst the principles that we have, I'm sorry? This is in the regular art scroll, it's on page 179, and then goes to 181. The 12th principle is, I believe, ani ma'amin, and you know this as a song, be'emuna shlema, with complete whole emuna, trust and faith, beviat hamashiach, in the coming of Mashiach, v'afal pi shayit mameach, and even though he may delay or tarry, im koze achakelo, even so, I wait and anticipate, b'chol yom shayavo, I anticipate every day that he will come, so that there is this enthusiastic, expectant waiting. It's not like, oh, he's not coming, never mind. It's not here yet, but coming. More like how a parent probably says to a child, it's like, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Just around the next bend, we're almost there, we're almost there. And the kids are like, I don't believe it. And are we there yet? But we're supposed to ask like that. We're supposed to say, I'm waiting with with bated breath waiting, not I gave up waiting or I'm not waiting. It's like, I am waiting and I'm waiting with joy. If we look at Jewish life, yes, Eileen.
So if the Mashiach comes and the world is restored and Yetzer Hara doesn't exist, what is our purpose?
Our purpose will be to enjoy the divine presence and live our lives with, back to how Adam and Chava had the potential to live their lives in the Garden of Eden, where the Yetzer Hara was external to them, so they still had choices to make, but it wasn't such a battle. So it says that God will kill the Malach HaMavet, and we have that on Pesach. Then and when we sing, what song is it? Is it Chad Gadya? And the Atah Kadosh Baruch Hu, he will kill Shochet, he will kill the Malach HaMavet. He will kill death. That's an oxymoron. It's like, get rid of that. But we will still live. There will be a different dimension to our living. It will be with clarity, and we will go back to having just a different perception of reality, and the battle will not be as strong. I'm willing to take it. I'll take it. Whenever it comes, I'll take it, whatever that's going to be. Let's have it. But if you look at Judaism, if you look at how many things are designed to inculcate in us the ability to wait. Think about all the waiting we have to do. For things, never mind the things that we have to say no to that are forbidden to us. Okay, so you can wait all you want. Bless you. You're not going to have a bacon and cheese sandwich. You're not going to have that. You're not going to have that. So don't wait for that. But the things that are permitted to us are things that we have to wait for. So Rabbi Wilson gave the example. He said, a non-Jew, let's say he's at a hotel. A non-Jew can get up in the morning, wake up in the morning, push the button or whatever, and get room service and have breakfast in bed, just like as they are. No problem. What does a Jew need to do? Before you even get out of bed, you have to say, Mode Ani, thank God for restoring your soul. Then you need to ritually wash your hands. You go to the bathroom. You get dressed. You say the blessings after using the bathroom. And then before you eat anything, you go and you daven shachrit, daven the morning prayers. That could take up to an hour, depending on how long you do that. Then you come back, and let's say you want some toast. Well, you can't just like pop that in your mouth. You have to wash your hands, recite the blessing, sit down, say the blessing over the bread. Some people salt it, and then you do it. And then after it's done, not so fashionable, just get up and go play tennis. Birkat HaMazon. And sometimes people say, oh, I don't want to eat bread because I don't want to say Birkat HaMazon. You know, it's like my day needs to, I can't wait for that. So, yeah, it is a good diet. It's like all of these things, wait, everything in its process. Then let's say you have some sort of a fleishik meal. It's like, well, then can you go out right away and have ice cream? No, even if you're Dutch, you have to wait an hour. If you're some foreign German, 3 hours, and the rest of the Ashkenazi world, 6 hours. It's like, you can't do whatever you want whenever you want to. And it's Shabbos, you wanted, oh, there's a sale. I always get these sales for Saturday, one day only. It's like, I guess, oh, well.
No, but it's also Friday.
Yes, right. Yes.
Look carefully.
I saw it starts at 3. Yeah, okay, it starts at, but it's like after Shabbos. Okay. Yeah, it depends. Yeah, sometimes it works out. Sometimes Shabbos is out early enough on Saturday, you can still get there Saturday night. But all these things, it's like, no, need to wait. A man and a woman, a husband and a wife, they can't have intimacy whenever they want. Oh, mikvah? Oh, you have to wait. You're still bleeding, okay, those times, plus 7 days, plus go to the mikveh, wait for it. It's an amazing thing what that does, and it creates the ability and the discipline to wait, because we're the people who are waiting for redemption. But we wait not with exasperation, and not with impatience, and not with hostility and anger, but it's a joyful waiting. It's a joyful waiting. It's like, I'm counting, I'm waiting. Even if we look at going from Pesach into Shavuos, it's like the Jewish people, they had to wait to receive the Torah, even though they ended up, you know, boggling it in the end with waiting for Moshe. They still had to wait the 49 days. Part of bringing them up to a level of spiritual purification was the waiting in and of itself. You can't pre-count. It's not like a post-dated check or a pre-dated check. You can't count your days of Sfirat HaOmer, of counting the Omer. You can't count them in advance and say, I'll just count 10 days and just fast-forward myself to the next day. It's like, no, one day at a time. One day at a time. So being in the mindset of being able to be in this process is in and of itself the path to redemption. So when we go to, oh, and this is the other thing that Rabbi Wolfson didn't say, but I also thought, is the red heifer is a female cow. Okay? the Jewish people built a calf. So there is a saying, and I had never understood it before, where it says, the mother should come and clean up after its baby. Okay, so that the para aduma, which negates and overturns the mistake that the Jewish people made when they brought death into the world, with the para aduma, cleans up the sin of the golden calf, which was not being able to wait. And each time we have that, so that the two of them are linked there, that the mother cleans up from the baby. So God willing, we have. Yes, Diane?
Is there any relationship between this parasha and the other two parasha for this Shabbat?
I'm sure there are other ones. Even just the rest of the Vayakel and Pekudei focus on the building of the sanctuary. And this building of the sanctuary of that place, of being that place where there is that intense holiness, and the para aduma of returning us, a person, to a state of kedusha. So you could make that connection as well. I'm sure there are many others as well. But that all of this is about the holiness that we are trying to reach before we turn that page. And it's not just turning the page to the month of Nisan, but where we will go up back to the top level and be prepared for the light that is ready to flow down on us with spiritual wisdom, connection, insight, and revelation that will come to us in the month of Nisan. So God willing, we'll read this, we won't understand it, and we'll be happy not understanding, and we'll be happy waiting for the redemption that is sure to come. Have a wonderful Shabbos.